It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We'll take you to an animal sanctuary in southern Indiana, to a food hub slash online grocery store that operates all over the Midwest. Then,
when people hear the word fungi, they think of Italian fungi, which means mushrooms, but in the Caribbean, it's a dish of cornmeal mush with okra.
Daniel Orr and Bob Adkins are both making dishes that feature corn. Tips about preserving corn also coming up today. And we touch base with a couple families who struggle with food allergies. Reporter Alex Daly gets their reactions to the increase in the price of EpiPens. First, big news this week. Here's Mark Chilla.
When it comes to acquiring and subsequently becoming the largest seed and pesticide maker in the world, Bayer AG doesn't know when to quit. And as of this week, it looks like it paid off, or perhaps paid out is a better phrase. This week, Bayer sent Monsanto a twice-sweetened offer of $128 a share, or $66 billion, to acquire the St. Louis-based biotechnology company. After months of playing hard to get, Monsanto accepted the offer Wednesday morning. Together, Bayer and Monsanto will create the largest crop supply company in the world, selling 29% of the world's seeds and 24% of the world's pesticides. Monsanto has continually faced controversy over its genetically modified crop seeds, as well as its glyphosate-based weed killer, Roundup. Last year, glyphosate was found to be probably carcinogenic to humans by the World Health Organization's Cancer Agency, but also unlikely to cause carcinogenic risk to humans from exposure through diet by a joint study this year between the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and the WHO. Those issues and others made Monsanto the third most hated company in the world, according to a 2014 poll. If the Monsanto brand ceases to exist, it creates an opportunity for their reputation to disappear while their products remain. The merger is still only proposed. Both companies face a lengthy regulatory process and review in more than 30 jurisdictions in countries across the globe. In the event that the merger is not approved, Bayer has agreed to pay Monsanto $2 billion. A final ruling on the legality of the merger is expected by the end of 2017. And we should totally be happy about all these food recalls and foodborne disease outbreaks. Or more like we should be glad we know about them, at least. According to Quartz and food watcher Marion Nestle, it's a sign that the system is starting to work. A decade ago, the number of yearly recalls hovered between 30 and 50. By 2015, that number jumped to 150, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Food safety advocates say those gains are due to better legislation. The Food Safety Modernization Act, which was signed into law in 2011, made sweeping changes to the way the government tracks outbreaks, sends alerts, and issues recalls. The law is slowly going into effect, and it gives the government more oversight, allows them to force companies to take more responsibility for testing, and to force companies to take action if diseases are detected in their factories. Statistics from the Centers for Disease Control show that illnesses during outbreaks declined by more than half from 1998 to 2014. There's more to read at eartheats.org, including a report that says 50 years ago, the sugar industry paid Harvard scientists for research that shifted the focus away from sugar's role in heart disease.
That's a story from NPR's Food Desk. We also post Harvest public media stories on the Earth Eats website. It's a good place to touch base with from time to time to see what's up in food news. Thanks to you, Mark, for presenting our headlines.
Glad to do it.
When you're buying meat at the grocery store, you're confronted with all kinds of brands and labels. How can you know if the meat you're buying came from animals that were raised humanely? As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, organic producers want to answer that question for you.
All right, so I just ordered dinner here at the Hub Cafe in Lincoln, Nebraska. This is a spot that serves a lot of local food, a lot of organic food. So now I'm going to go back in the kitchen and see what I can find out about how that chicken I ordered was actually raised.
So So Plum Creek Farms is a local farm that produces organically raised chicken. They're all free range.
That's Chef Andrew DiDonato giving me the backstory on my chicken sizzling in the skillet. It turns out it lived pretty well for a chicken meant for slaughter. DiDonato says the chickens he serves live most of the year outside on pasture.
Makes for a really tasty chicken and a really happy chicken.
The Hub Cafe taps into a couple big food trends. Most of the food is local, and all the meat is so-called humanely raised, like the pasture-raised chicken. It's even certified by a group called Animal Welfare Approved. Krista Dittman is one of the restaurant's owners. She knows a lot about the food she eats. She knows the farmers, she's been to their farms, and Dittman admits that's a lot easier for her than her customers.
Certainly there are people who make it their life's work to know where their food comes from, but that's not always feasible for everyone.
The rest of us start at the grocery store, where product labels are crowded with claims about how these animals live. Free range, no antibiotics, cage-free, veggie-fed, pasture-raised, and that's just on a carton of eggs. So what's a shopper to do? The organic industry is looking to cut through the clutter and stake its own claim with carnivores suffering a crisis of conscience.
We want organic to be the gold standard for what consumers are looking for a differentiated product.
That's Nate Lewis of the Organic Trade Association. The OTA is supporting an update for organic animal welfare guidelines so that in the minds of shoppers, organic means more humane. Among other things, Lewis says the new standards tell farmers how much space to give their chickens. They prohibit practices like tail docking for cattle, that is, cutting the tail short. And animals have to be able to go outdoors when weather allows. Lewis says it's up to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the organic program, to approve the new rules.
What's going to differentiate this regulation from other animal welfare claims is the oversight of the federal government.
That gives organic producers something that other farmers don't have, a USDA seal of approval that suggests organic livestock live better lives. And that's brought on complaints from groups that represent conventional livestock farmers. Dan Kovich is a veterinarian with the National Pork Producers Council.
We're certainly not saying that animal welfare is not important. It's just concern for animal welfare is not in any way unique to organic production.
Conventional farm groups say having the USDA behind organic standards reflects negatively on their products, whether or not you prefer organic methods. A conventional dairy producer, for instance, might not cut the tails off his cows, but because he doesn't use organic feed at his dairy, there's no government label for him. Candace Crony is director of the Center for Animal Welfare Science at Purdue University. She says as consumer values become a bigger part of food marketing, the preferred status of organic products creates friction with conventional producers.
For many people, they're also competing with this idea that organic food is safer, more nutritious, and frankly better for you and better for the environment.
The reality behind those assumptions is more complicated. Organic is better for the environment in some ways, but probably not in others. That leaves farmers worried about the cost of measuring up if they can't sell at organic prices.
And they feel that they are under social pressure to do what other people are doing that they may not actually even feel is the right thing to do, or the safe thing to do, or a good thing to do.
The new organic animal welfare standards are expected to be finalized by the end of the year. When that happens, it could clear up some questions for consumers, but leave division behind the plate. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Thanks to Grant and all the reporters that work at Harvest. Connect with them on Twitter at HarvestPM and on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. A conversation now with Matt Ewer, one of the founders of Green Bean Delivery. He got his start as a food businessman when he was a youngster.
Ironically enough, I sold sweet corn door to door when I was a kid. And we had a family farm that was farmed by another family. We put sweet corn along the side of the field corn because I asked my dad when I was little, I said, where's all the corn that you can eat, right? And he explained, well, this is all for cows. But beside the point, we would go out there, harvest the sweet corn. I'd take it back to Marion, Indiana, where I'm from, fill up the van and put it in the garage. And I would literally go door to door. Red Flyer wagon. I know it's probably bringing up images of Norman Rockwell and all this stuff in your mind. People would wait on me. You know, and I started to get a reputation, and maybe that was a lesson for me at a very young age, that people wanted to be connected to agriculture and people wanted to have a face with their food.
He came into the Earth Eats studios last year. His business, Green Bean, is an online, on-demand grocery store where the food comes to you. A lot of it is organic and regionally sourced from mid-size farms.
We're trying to mix the service that you get from, you know, a more streamlined grocery with the service that you can get from a CSA or a farmer's market and put those things together. And when we do that, we create a commercially viable product. And then when we turn our support over to a local farmer and artisan, we really make impact on their business and their family farm. That's how you cultivate change.
Ewer knows what it's like for farmers because he is one. He worked at Strangers Hill Organics when he lived in Bloomington, Indiana. He now helps run two certified organic farms as part of the Green Bean business, one in Indiana and the other in Ohio. From the farmer's perspective, they deliver their food to one of the company's six distribution centers: Indianapolis, Louisville, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Nashville, and Columbus, Ohio. And Green Bean does the work of getting the food to customers. When he describes it like that, it sounds a lot like something we've talked about before on Earth Eats.
You know, food hubs are interesting conversations. I hear a lot about food hubs. We've been going since 2007, and we consider ourselves a food hub. So when I hear those conversations, oftentimes I'm like, hey, over here, you know, check us out, you know. You know, food hubs are not just about the brick and mortar, right? The concept of a roof over food, right? It's actually, what is the business model? And that's what we're trying to show is, you know, viable business models, market solutions to get local food, sustainable food, organic food to consumers at an affordable level, make it very accessible and easy for people to get to. So we want it to be a key, convenient, affordable, and accessible.
If you play around on the Green Bean website, you'll see organic food from the United States, but only six different foods labeled from Indiana. He says that's because farmers are still tied to the harvest season. So right now you can score some peppers, apples, microgreens, and mushrooms supplied by Indiana farms. Grapefruit comes from somewhere else in the country. The website doesn't specify. And your ginger root, well, that flies in from Peru. Ewer puts it into perspective.
It is about local food. Next to that, it's about regional food. Next to that, it's about national food. And those all come together in kind of a food security conversation, right? If California dries up, you know, are we going to have the ability to really support ourselves, make sure we can still eat our lovely fruits and vegetables? Right now, I'd argue that we don't. And, you know, what my company is trying to do is build commercial viability and business solutions and sustainability for family farms.
One more quick search of the Green Bean website. Sweet corn. There it is, grown in Ohio. Matt Ewer is the CEO of Green Bean Delivery. Their website is greenbeandelivery.com. We've got corn on the brain today. Three different recipes coming up on Earth Eats. For most of us, farm animals are out of sight and out of mind. That's partly why Michelle Pruitt helped found Uplands Peak Sanctuary. They rescue animals that would have been killed for food, and they let them live out their lives on their property in southern Indiana. They opened their barn doors in fall of 2012, and now they're housing two of the most charismatic pigs you'd ever have the pleasure of meeting.
You know, they can come from cases like these guys escaped, but pigs also fall off trucks on the way to slaughter. They fall off transport trucks, and then they don't really have a place where they could go live out their life.
How did you get her on your property? What's her story?
Okay. Annie and her brother Andy actually came from Minneapolis, and although it's illegal, there's a lot of backyard butcher that happens. So they believe that, you know, these guys escaped from someone's backyard. And I'm pretty sure Annie led the escape because she's pretty smart, pretty spunky, and definitely of the two has been the leader. So Andy still had twine wrapped around his back legs, and they were roaming in a field in the middle of downtown Minneapolis. So the local animal control picked them up, and, you know, their story was on Facebook because there really wasn't anyone locally that would take in a farm pig that, you know, knew how to care for them, but most importantly was going to let them live out their life.
What do you get from having them in your life?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's where the immense gratitude comes from, and it is hard work, so don't get me wrong. You know, when it was negative 20 and I had to come, you know, fill waters and scoop poop, I probably had to count my blessings a little more that day. But you know, really to see these animals and to get to know them as the individuals that they are. You know, like yesterday I came in and snuggled up with Andy, and Andy, I like to tuck them in. So I kind of put their straw around them real good every day. And Annie just kind of squeezed in between me and Andy and laid her head on my knee and just let me love on her. You know, for me, I'm glad that I'm able to do that for them, but there's also this piece of knowing that I was part of the cycle of violence that all animals are in, that it's kind of like in some way I get to make up for that now.
Michelle Pruitt of Uplands Peak Sanctuary. Information at uplandspeaksanctuary.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. This is Earth Eats. Thanks for being here. If you're buying up the last few ears of fresh corn at the market, consider preserving them to enjoy in December and January. I spoke with our blogger Amy Jeanroy about preserving techniques for corn. That day, I just happened to catch her in the kitchen in the middle of a huge project.
Well, my husband found someone who had 4 more boxes of tomatoes, so I canned 30 pounds.
Amy uses a bit of an unusual recipe when she's preserving corn. She says it goes against everything you've been taught about canning.
But it works. I use it year after year. It's so easy that I like to use it as a beginner recipe for a lot of the younger people are asking, oh, how do I get started doing all, you know, putting food up for the winter? And I'll say, hey, the corn's going right now. Why don't you cut it off the cob and do this to it? It's just a good beginner recipe for starting to put things away. Not so daunting as some people think canning can be.
What you'd do normally to preserve corn is you blanch the ears, then shock them in cold water, slice the kernels off the cob, put that and the corn liquid into a canning jar, heat it up to just about simmering, then freeze it. Jean Roy's recipe, on the other hand, is much simpler. Cut fresh corn off the cob, mix it with water, sugar, and salt, and bag it up, and you're done. And her family seems to like it. She uses this corn in a variety of ways in her cooking over the winter months.
For our family, I like to freeze it in 4 cups in a bag for some of it, because that I use in my corn chowder or my fish chowder, potato, any kind of cream-based soup. And then for 2-cup batches, that's just a side dish. So all you would do is take it out of the freezer, thaw it, and heat it up, and it's ready to serve.
Follow along with Amy at eartheats.org. Click on the newest podcast post and you'll see her article toward the bottom. Along with this recipe, Chef Bob Adkins is making a creamy sauce to spoon over some grilled corn on the cob.
Okay, so we're gonna start with about 1/2 cup of sour cream, 1/2 cup of mayonnaise. You can use, you know, regular mayonnaise, you could use light mayonnaise if you want, no fat mayonnaise. In that, we're going to put some grated Parmesan, some fresh grated Parmesan right off the giant wheel. Garlic chili paste, it's the red sriracha style stuff. If you don't have the chili paste, you can use sriracha. About 1/2 lime juiced into there also. A little bright citrus note. We're gonna use some cilantro, very classic Central American Mexican herb. take a whisk to it. This is gonna add a really rich, rich coating to your grilled corn, which should be getting pretty close. And I don't know if you can hear it or not.
That's popping. The corn is popping.
It is popping, and it's okay if you get a little charred on one side, you can just leave it out. It bounces out on the other side. You just want to get some nice color to it. Like I said, if you've steamed in advance, you just want to get a little bit of the caramelization to it. You can get it as dark as you want, or you can leave it as light as you want. It also burns off a lot of those little hairs that might have slipped through your fingers during the shucking process. Okay, so we're gonna spoon a little bit over the top, and that is your Mexican-style grilled corn.
We also have a recipe for corn and avocado chowder and a succotash. That's on my top five list of favorite recipes. Find more at eartheats.org. Last week, we talked to a couple families about the stresses and the joys of living with food allergies. Reporter Alex Daly got back in touch with those families when she heard news about EpiPen increasing their prices. Alex carries two EpiPens with her at all times because of her own food allergies, so this news hit especially close to home. Here's her story of how two families are adjusting to the price hike.
We all carry different things in our bags. Chapstick, gum, wallet, keys, phones.
Always in the bottom, unfortunately.
But Stephanie Montgomery carries something very important in her bag.
It has my name and it says EpiPen Auto Injection Kit. Inject as directed in emergency. And I just realized my prescription refill ended on July 30th.
Oh gosh.
So I need to make sure I get a current prescription.
Montgomery is allergic to wheat and peanuts. Her 11-year-old son, Nolan, is allergic to corn. When they experience an allergic reaction, they rely on their EpiPens for a potentially life-saving dosage of epinephrine until proper treatment can begin. The medication expires after about 1 year, and when she goes to refill the prescription this year, the trip may cost her over $600.
And I'll have to choose which ones am I going to replace, which ones, you know, it'll be obviously the one at school will get replaced before it expires, the one that in his pouch probably as well because the school checks his pouch. We'll probably not replace the ones in my purse and in our cabinets.
In 2007, the pharmaceutical company Mylan purchased the rights for EpiPen auto-injectors, a product that has been on the market since 1977. 10 years ago, one EpiPen cost about $57. But since 2010, the cost has seen a 400% price increase to $600. Christine Hitchcock has two kids, 12-year-old Zach and 10-year-old Abby. They have allergies to many foods, including soy, dairy, eggs, and all nuts.
We have seen the price go up enough that when the spring when I went in to get another set, the lady at Target at the pharmacy said, "You do know this is going to cost $600." I said, "No, I did not know that, but thank you for letting me know. I'm going to go have a meltdown in the parking lot right now." It wasn't that bad, but it was shocking.
For families like the Hitchcocks and Montgomerys, EpiPens are necessary to have at the ready. While generic and alternative versions of EpiPens exist, Montgomery has concerns about using them.
Often, school children are in the care of a classroom teacher or a health aide who is not a nurse. They're all trained to use EpiPens, Mylan brand EpiPens. They're not all trained. If a kid doesn't have this kind, here's how you use the generic. If a kid doesn't have that, here's how you open the epinephrine ampule and draw up the solution in the syringe. They're not trained in those. I'm not going to have my child be in a position where he has something different in his pouch than somebody's ever seen before, and they don't know what to do to save him.
In response to the public outcry against the high prices, Mylan said it plans to release a generic version of the device in the near future with a $300 price tag. But Hitchcock doesn't think that'll do much to lessen the financial burden.
It's only going to cost $300, which sounds great compared to $600, but why is it still $300? That's still a big increase over what it cost like in 2007, 2008, 2010.
To avoid the high costs, Montgomery carries expired EpiPens in hopes that during an emergency situation, the medication will still be effective.
I shouldn't have to decide, am I willing to take the risk to have, you know, potentially ineffective medicine in my home that is supposed to be saving my child's life.
For Earth Eats, I'm Alex Daly.
Alex is a student at Indiana University. More stories like these are at eartheats.org. Here's another recipe with corn, cornmeal, actually. Daniel Orr is by the stove. This dish doubles as a good suggestion for cooking okra. Get them while they're still small and you can eat them without deep frying them to death.
All right, so we have some okra right here today. Really one of my favorite vegetables of summertime. When you pick them, I like to pick them from my garden when they're super small, about an inch long. And then I eat them raw. I eat them, the stem and all. They're really, really tender. They're delicious. They've got a beautiful, almost hibiscus-like flower, and they are a member of the hibiscus family. But generally, what you want to be able to do is to take the tip and break it. If the tip doesn't break off and if it's got strings in it, then it's too old. Today we're going to make an island fonji. So I just added a quart of water to a hot pan. And this is an island dish. It's almost like a polenta. When people hear the word fonji, they think of Italian fonji, which means mushrooms. But in the Caribbean, it's a dish of cornmeal mush with okra. All right. So to that quart of water, we're going to add 4 tablespoons of butter, 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic, and then our 1 cup of cornmeal. And you can use your quick cooking cornmeal, which will cook quickly. And we're going to stir that in. Now, you heard me when I poured that water in. It was nice hot water into a hot pan. So this is going to boil real quick. And as it cooks, it will thicken up nicely. So I'm just going to take a whisk, really make sure that all those clumps are out of there. And you're going to taste it, and you just want that kind of raw cornmeal taste to come out. All right, so it's a very bland flavor now because we just have the butter and the cornmeal and the garlic. So we're going to start adding our seasonings. Salt and pepper, of course, our freshly ground pepper. And this should be kind of an aggressively flavored and seasoned dish because usually they would serve this with goat stew or a goat curry. So it's got to kind of stand up to those flavors. And then we're going to finish it with some grated Parmesan cheese. Okay, that's tasting good. I'm just going to add a little more salt. Now that it's nice and bubbling and it's cooked through, I'm going to take the okra and I've sliced it into 1/4-inch thick pieces. And we don't really need to cook it much after this because we want the okra to retain its integrity and to have kind of a crunch to it. So that is our Caribbean island fonji with okra and grated Parmesan.
This is also at eartheats.org. Thanks to all the employees at Farm Bloomington for their help with Earth Eats. Aabon Binder snaps pictures for us and keeps the website in order. Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow write for the blog. And John Bailey is Earth Eats executive producer. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Good day to you.